Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, we made it. It's Christmas in July. It's the Big 300 show. Lots of surprises in store. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and friends. Episode 300, recorded July 9th, 2014. The Big 300. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneAge.com, bringing you each week, or as often as I can, the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and not aware of it, projects you might want to find more stuff out about. At least that's what we normally do, but this is a very special show. This is our Christmas in July show. This is episode 300 of Floss Weekly, and I thought I would take a little bit of time to reflect back on what Floss Weekly has meant for me and what I think I've been able to accomplish with the show, and also talk a little bit with our other frequent co-hosts and see what their opinions and all that stuff is, and maybe even get some discussion with people in the chat room and things like that. So no plans today. We're just winging it. We're winging it live. But first, let me bring on my wonderful and talented co-host. Let's first go to Aaron in the studio. Aaron Newcomb, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Randall. How's it going? Good to be here.
Going well. And you're coming to us from, of course, the Brick House, which is where this show gets mixed down every week.
That's right.
Or whatever we're doing. And I guess it's every week, right?
Yeah.
And then let's also bring all the way from Liverpool, Dan Lynch. Dan Lynch, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's good to be here. Always fun.
It's a little crazy having two co-hosts on today, but we're just basically going to open this up for a discussion and bouncing stuff back and forth. And there we are, all three of us, if you're watching the video, all three of us on camera at once. That's pretty darn cool. So I wanted to sort of open the show with my sort of a little bit of the history of the show, how I got involved. And then we can have each of you two also talk about how you got involved and what it's been like for you. I actually did not create this show. The show is a creation of Leo Laporte and Chris DeBona. And they started the show and ran about 17 episodes, of which I was actually interviewed on episode 9 for. And then we went into Podfade. Chris had a baby, or actually his wife had the baby, but he was involved, I understand. And so he got kind of tied up. I guess when you have a baby, you have very little sleep, and you're, you know, between work and sleep, it's a little bit crazy. So this show went into Podfade this back in, I think, 2006, 2007, something like that.
Did you say Podfade?
Podfade. You've never heard of that?
No, cool. I like that.
Isn't that a great word?
Yeah.
Yeah, Podfade.
Yeah.
Now we don't have our handoff, our behind the scenes handoff. So now we're just talking over the top of each other. This is crazy. I should probably even, we could talk about behind the scenes as well. I think I'd kind of like to get into some of that. One of the reasons that you don't hear us stomping on each other all the time when we're asking questions is we figured pretty early on that we would have a back channel chat. And so I'll open the show and ask a few questions. Of course, now I'm mixing this up with the history. Oh, well. It's my show. I'll do whatever I want. Okay, so we have a back channel chat for a while. I opened the show for a while. Now I got to wake up. More caffeine. And then when I've asked four or five questions, so I open the show and I ask maybe five or six sort of establishing questions with the guest. But in the meanwhile, I'm also chatting with the co-host, whoever it is, and we go back and forth a little bit. And I say, okay, you're start asking questions, And then that's why we don't have two hosts asking questions at the same time. So you'll notice in all the shows, I ask questions for a while, and the co-host will ask questions for a while, and I'll ask more questions for a while, and it'll go back and forth like four or five times. And that works. It's without us all being in the same room at the same time, we needed some way to kind of control who's actually taking charge of the conversation. So that's why. Now, back to what I was talking about, history. Okay, so I happened to be on Leo's show that was filming in Vancouver, BC, Lab with Leo, I think it was called. Yeah. And one day I'm asking him what happened to Floss Weekly. He says, well, we need Chris DeBona is tied up. And we were talking about getting maybe another co-host to bring in some of the guests. And I said, well, what would it take to have me be on there as a co-host? He goes, well, bring me some guests. So I did. I took over the show. It was monthly for a little while. Then I've got it all the way back up to weekly. And it's been a lot of fun since then. It's started out bringing all my friends first as guests. And then I started crowdsourcing, and I think that was the big change in the show. I actually asked y'all out there that are listening to provide people that you wanted to have be interviewed for this show. And that really changed the nature of it. It really made it more your guys' show. And also it helped me out because I, at least in the last couple of years, I've always been saying, I don't want to just know about a project. I want to know, I want you to go contact the project leader and have them email me. And that's how pretty much all the shows in the last few years have been done. And it's really helped me out because, you know, I have limited time to work on this thing. I prepare for the show only for about an hour before the show. And I spend probably about another half hour to an hour a week emailing people and trying to coordinate the co-hosts, the possible guests, things like that. So it's pretty fascinating. I think I'm just hearing myself talk now. So, Dan, how'd you get involved with the show?
Well, I'd actually been podcasting for about 3 years, doing a show called Linux Outlaws, which we talk about sometimes, with my co-host in Germany, Fabian. And we were doing a weekly show about Linux and open source and all kinds of stuff. And I think, Randall, you were a guest on the show before I joined Floss Weekly, because we kind of got talking. We had some mutual friends. And then at the time when Johnny Bacon, one of our, another friend of mine, former co-host, mm-hmm. was leaving because he was too busy, he had some scheduling conflicts and so on, I actually shot him an email saying, would you mind if I don't know, I wanted to be polite about it. Maybe I'm being very British about it, but I thought I'd shoot him an email and so he didn't think I was just trying to steal his job or something, and say, do you mind mm-hmm. if I put my name in the hat for Floss Weekly? And he said, well, yeah, go for it if you want. And I think that's what I did. I must be the only, I think I may be the only co-host who's never been a guest on Floss Weekly, so somehow I just snuck in there. I don't really know how that happened, but yeah, I snuck my way in there, and it's been fun. It's been really good. That would have been 2010, I think mid 2010, something like that. I joined, so it's 4 years now I've been doing the show, and it's always good fun, and it's been a great experience.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And when I look back and realize I've been doing this show for, I guess, almost 7 years now, because I picked it up in, I think, 2007. I should probably go look. There's a Floss Weekly Wikipedia page, which I'm really happy for, because other people maintain it for me, and I can go back and look and see who our past guests are. But, you see, so I was a guest on July of 2006, and I picked up the show as a co-host in, it was for Josh Burka, so it'd be July of 2007. So I've been doing this show, God, 7 years now. Wow. Okay, no wonder it feels like a long time. You know, I've got to say, though, some people write me something. They say, could you put this project on your show? And I can't remember if we've done a show on that or not. So I actually have to Google. I Google Floss Weekly and a project name a lot to see if we've actually done a show on it or not, because there's just been so many, many different shows. Well, in 300 shows, obviously, there's quite a bit there. So, Aaron, how did you get involved with the show?
Well, you can see I'm deep in thought, thinking back, way back, to my early days of Floss Weekly. I started a show in... I started listening to Twit, really, with podcasts back in 2006, when it first came on. And I thought, hey, this is a great idea, podcasting. So I started my own show about open source, the first video podcast that I know of about open source. It was called The Source. I did like 20 or 30 episodes. It was very random, and it was fun, but I did it all myself using open source software. It's very difficult, actually. And so I did that for a while, and then I heard about Floss Weekly shortly after I started that show, and I thought, hey, this is kind of cool, an audio podcast about open source. So I was a listener, and then I thought, mm-hmm. I should really get my projects on there. So I was a guest. I first came on to talk about ZFS because mm-hmm. I was working at Sun at the time, and then I think I came back on, I don't know, maybe 4 or 6 months later to talk about the editor that I use to do my podcast that I was doing called Cinelera. And that's one of the great things about this show, before I continue with the history. The great thing about this show is you can go back. It's all archived. So you can go back. It's, mm-hmm. it's funny. I can go back and watch that episode that I was on, the first episode I was on, talking about ZFS, and thinking, well, who's that crazy guy? He doesn't know what he's talking mm-hmm. about. But that's one of the cool things about this show is you can go back and find those old archives of any of the shows, and some of them are still, most of them are still relevant, I would say. But anyway, so then a little bit later on, I don't know how actually that I came about. Did I contact you, Randall? I don't even remember.
I think I was looking for, when Jono had to leave, because we moved to an earlier time slot, I knew I had to fill his shoes, and I filled it with five people because I knew it was, I didn't have to have somebody in our rotating co-host panel. And even now, it's still like, you know, sometimes with the five of you that we have currently, their co-hosts, it's sometimes we can't fill all the slots. So it's tough. It's a tough scheduling. I mean, it's a weekly show, and it takes, you know, a good 2.5 hours out of my Wednesday morning. So it's something that I have to manage that way. So yeah, I think I contacted you about because I knew you also had a podcast. So I was trying to find other fellow podcasters to do that. So
yeah, I think that's what it was. And then, you know, around that same time, I moved out here to California, which made it a lot easier for me to come in to the cottage and then later on here to the brick house to help. So, yeah, that was kind of the genesis of it. And it's been a lot of fun and a good run. I mean, it's fun because I can often point people back to episodes that I've done as a reference. And I know we're going to get to this in a little bit, but just even this past Monday, I was at our Benicia Makerspace meeting and we had the mayor there, and our mayor had gone to the White House Maker Fair. And so we asked her to come to our meeting and kind of, you know, give an update on what that was like and everything. And that was all cool. And she said, well, one of my favorite projects was these guys that built this underwater submersible thing. And you can pilot it around, and they were at Maker Faire, and it's really cool. And I said, oh, yeah, you mean Open ROV? And she's like, oh, yeah, how do you know about that? I said, well, I interviewed these guys, you know, on Floss Weekly. And so I knew all about it, and I was able to tell people about how they use BeagleBoard internally to the Open ROV, which is interesting for makers, you know, because we're all into Arduinos and Raspberry Pis and stuff. So it's interesting how over time, all of these topics, and we've had some really great guests, but how they all kind of come back, and it's like, oh yeah, I did talk to those guys on Floss Weekly a couple years ago, in fact. So it's been really interesting to talk to all these different people and personalities and people that are involved in projects, like you say, that you may never have heard of, but then once you start talking about it, it's like, wow, this is really cool.
Yeah, and that's been my treat, too, is that being able to talk to the people that have been behind the projects that I have used in various forms when I'm in different locations. And so it's always a thrill for me to do that. And I want to touch on something you said a little bit earlier, which was that, you know, I've sort of maneuvered this show. Maybe it was already that way before I took it over, but to really be more of a magazine rather than a newspaper. So these shows are meant to be sort of timeless, except for our little news piece at the end, or maybe our news piece at the beginning. And as a stack of reference material for all these projects that are there. That's I sometimes have people want to come back and, you know, do an update or something, but I've actually tended to shy away from that because there's so many other projects out there that I want to interview first. But you know, we've had some noteworthy people like the Salt Stack people. Have now been on with an update because they went in a whole new direction with their stuff to do cloud management and things. So, and also the impact that that's had for some of these projects, like speaking of Salt, I've been told by the project leaders there that putting Salt on Floss Weekly really exposed them to a whole new audience and really sort of made the project for them. And so they're very appreciative about that. And also sort of in parallel with that, I kind of knew that I had done the groundwork for really establishing Floss Weekly as a leader in the podcasting world for open source software when I started getting calls from PR companies, an email from PR companies saying, our client wants to be on your show. And I now get about one of those requests every quarter, maybe even a little more often than that. And that tells me that Floss Weekly has moved from just being this casual thing that we're chatting about into actually being, you know, legitimate press, legitimate media that people know that their clients need to be on the show. You guys have any thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, I certainly have. I mean, I've certainly had people come up to me and say, you know, so that goes both ways. So I've had people come up to me and say, you know, we saw that show. Is there any way I can get my so-and-so on the CEO or something on the show, right? I've had that happen, but I've also had the opposite happen, which is, I think, just being in the open source community where you say, oh, that guy that you had on the show, he's a shill or something, or he, you know, some negative feedback for getting people on the show that maybe they think aren't really involved in the project or involved in the open source community. And I always say, look, we've got a really good track record. If you go back and look at all the shows we've done, of having people on the show that are directly involved. A lot of these guys are the people that write the code, or, you know, community managers that deal with, kind of bridge the gap between the software development people and the people like us who are interested in the programs. So I always come back at that pretty strongly, because I don't think that's really been the case over time. But I get it both ways. And I think you've done, Randall, a very good job of getting the right people on the show to talk about the projects in the way that our audience wants to hear. So kudos to you for that.
Thank you very much for that. Sorry, go Dan.
No, I was just going to say, I've got a bit of a question for you guys in a second, but I want to kind of lead into it with a very quick story. We're talking about the impact of Floss Weekly and so on. And there's no doubt that, like, I've met so many amazing people through doing this show, people who are really fundamental to free and open source software, you know, some people I thought I'd never really get to speak to. But a funny thing happened to me. I was in a bar in Liverpool, and this is the funny thing that's ever happened to me related to Floss Weekly. I was in a bar with a friend of mine, and this girl came over and said, "Do you Floss Weekly?" And I thought first she was asking about my dental hygiene or something, and I went, sorry? And she went, "Oh, do you do Floss Weekly?" And I went, "Oh, yeah, I do." And she actually recognized me from that, and turned out she was a Drupal developer, and a far better Drupal developer than me, but that's another matter. And it was really good. So I was just curious. I mean, you guys probably being in the States and going to a lot more of the open source events and stuff probably get this much more, but do you get recognized a lot from the show, and how's that kind of worked out?
Well, that's what's sort of bizarre about this. When I was doing all the hopefully my mic's on. Yes, when I was doing all the work with Perl, and I'm still heavily involved in the Perl community, but I was always wondering what would happen next. You know, what would be my next thing that would be my big contribution to the world? And you know, then Floss Weekly came along, and for the first couple of years, you know, it was sort of like, hey, Randall, love your Perl books, and hey, I hear you're doing this little podcast thing now. But I've got to say, in the last 3 years, as I've gone to, say, OSCON or even Perl conferences, you know, most people come up to me and say, "Love your show." And they don't talk about my books anymore. So, you know, I'm now famous for a new reason, which is actually was part of the goal. And I have to say a tiny bit of why I keep doing this. I want to be out in the public somehow, doing some sort of contribution in the world. And the books, you know, made an amazing change. I mean, I've often claimed that it helped enable the interactive web, but that might be a bit of a broad claim. But, you know, everybody was doing Perl back in the mid-90s. So, I kept wondering, what next? What would I be, you know, famous for next, or whatever way that would put? And clearly, it's really weird now. People are coming up to me, like I said, even at Perl conferences, and not talking about my books, they're talking about, you know, Floss Weekly and the show, and that they listen to it every week and stuff like that. So almost a day doesn't go by where I don't get email thanking me from one of my fans. So I really appreciate when you guys are there. Y'all listen to the show and helping me along with it by giving me ideas for guests and things like that. So but at least that's my experience. So Aaron, do you have a similar experience?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I have people come up to me. You know, the conferences that I go to are usually work related. And I work in the storage industry, so most of the time, there's not a lot of crossover there. There used to be more at Sun when we were doing ZFS, and for a while we were doing something called Open Storage, so there was more of a crossover there at that time. Mm-hmm. But these days, there's not a lot of crossover between the open source group and my professional life. But I do get people come up to me. I was at a storage conference in Texas one time, and some guy, he really seeked me out, and I was glad he did. I always tell people, don't be shy. I mean, if you recognize me or if you want to talk to me, I'm just a normal person. So, you know, I'm shy myself, and so I try to get other people to come up to me because I don't know them, and it's hard for me to, you know, introduce. I don't usually brag about what I do, or I don't say, hey, I'm Aaron Newcomb, and you know me from Twit and blah, blah, blah. I don't like to do that. So I always try to get people to come up to me, and I had had several people come up and say, oh, we know you from Floss Weekly, and sometimes it's the other shows I do on Twit too, but I'm always glad when somebody does that, because the fans of this show especially are always so good to talk to and so interested and involved and invested in what we're talking about that you really end up having excellent conversations with our audience members. You know, they'll come up and they'll, oh, I really love this show that you did. And then it'll always turn to, well, what do you think about this new project? Or have you heard of this? Or what do you think about that? And it's always a really good conversation. So I've had probably 3 or 4 run-ins, even at my storage conference, with people that know me from the show or have come up and introduced themselves, and it's always a great conversation. So I always encourage people to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Aaron, that's also been my experience too. Is that You know, one of the things that this show really does, and I really try to make sure that is, it's a big mix-up. It's a lot of different projects. And I've had people tell me that, you know, I'm not always interested in what you're talking about, but I always like to hear the stuff that you're talking about the things like, you know, how do they get started? How do they fund themselves? What licenses they chose and stuff like that. So, I'm getting whispered in my ear here. Apparently, we have some sort of caller. I didn't know we were taking live calls on this show, but apparently we have some sort of caller. Caller on the line? Caller, are you there? Maybe not. Caller? Are you there? Nope,
hello,
not yet.
Hello.
Not yet.
Hello,
oh, hello, hello. Yeah. So you have a question about Floss Weekly or something to add for the conversation?
Yeah. I mean, how is it possible that you've hit, you know, episode 300? I mean, that shows remarkable persistence. I mean, I seem to remember you had some hosts before, but they slacked off and were pretty useless. How did you guys make it work for so long?
Wait a second. I think I recognize that voice. Is that you, Chris DeBona? Is that you?
It is actually me.
Hey, Chris DeBona. Hey.
Welcome back to the show, Chris.
How's it going, guys? I even wore my ridiculous headphones from the last time I did this, like 200 episodes ago.
Oh, nice. Well, we mentioned you at the beginning of the show, but why don't you tell us in your own words how you got the show started and why you stopped after 17? That's what I want to know.
17 episodes. Oh, wow, that's really slacky. I mean, you're at 300. I mean, how we got started? You know, Leo's like, hey, we should do a Floss thing, and I'm like, all right. So we kicked it off. You know, I emailed some friends. I was like, hey, come pod vlogcast with me. And so we did. And we did a mere 17 shows. And it was great fun. But then a couple things happened. I'm trying to remember. I don't want to be a downer, but like there was some family medical drama with my parents and just, you know, work and kids and all this stuff happened. So all at the same time, and I was like, you know what, this is not working. So, and I seem to remember you were one of the early replacements. I mean, was it you the whole time?
Well, let's see. I was a guest on episode 9. You interviewed me there.
Yeah.
And then after Leo did your last guest, it was Mad Dog. He was talking about bringing Mad Dog on as a co-host, but that never came into being. So,
Mad Dog's like all over Brazil, yeah. And he's like,
yeah,
you know, that's
even a crazy schedule.
I don't even know if they have bandwidth in Brazil, right? I mean, no, I'm kidding.
During soccer I did the show season, right? Only during the World Cup.
Wow, yeah.
Let's not get into that.
Oh, let's not get into the World Cup.
So we have like cafeterias full of people watching this, and I'm just hearing, oh, and I'm like, what is going on, you know? And I go over there, and I'm like, is that score right? But yeah, so.
They actually had an American football score for a Brazilian football game for a change.
Yeah, really. Hey, they made their field goal. Yeah.
Point after touchdown. Yes, exactly.
No, I'm
all right,
actually,
all right. We're probably upsetting the Brazilians now. So you went off and had real life for a while. Have you paid attention to the show since then?
You know, I listen in now and then, you know, not very often, maybe 10, 12 episodes over the last couple of years, you know. I'm sort of a narcissist when it comes to radio. You know, if I'm not on it, why would I listen? You know, and no, I'm
no, I think we're all no, like that. I think we're all like that.
Actually,
I mean, I have
here's the thing. It's a really long show.
Yeah.
I mean, it tends to be quite long. And so I would start them, and then I would have, you know, like my commute is just not very long, right? So I would catch like the beginnings or like little snippets. And then, you know, my commute, I live like 2 miles away in Mountain View, right? So, you know, yeah. And my kids, when we're in the car, my kids don't want to, I know, horrifying to hear that kids are not in the Floss Weekly, but my daughter wants to listen to, you know, One Republic or whoever. And, you know, my son, he mostly wants to talk to me about Minecraft. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you had Minecraft Weekly, though, you guys would be up there.
Yeah, well, there is a Minecraft. Cool. There is a Minecraft
OMG
show that
craft,
we do. So.
Every...
Oh no! Don't get started, right? Because then we'll start talking about Long Notes and Dandy TM and these guys. I honestly can't believe it. So I work at Google. We own YouTube, right? And every once in a while, I'll meet like a YouTube star, like Hank Green or rest, and then I'll look at their views for an average episode, and it's like a 10th or a 20th of like the guys playing Minecraft together that my son is just crazy about, you know? So.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Anyway, so I agree with you. I don't listen to long shows. I'm a little surprised you're calling an hour a long show, because compared to most of the stuff on the Twit Network, it's short.
Yeah, I know. It's like, This Week in Tech is like 3 hours long, 5 hours long. I'm like, I can't do it.
Yeah, and even then, I still have to listen to all my podcasts at 1.5 speed. When I'm listening to playback on the live stream, I have to actually go, wow, why does the music sound slow? Why does everything sound slow? Because we do that deliberately. And this is part of what's actually, I think, one of the attractions of the show is that it's only 45 minutes of an interview, and then we do a little bit of news at the beginning and the end. And I think it gets you enough a taste of the projects that you can see whether you want to research it further or, whether it would fit into what you need or, we're still covering all the important things like why did they choose the license they chose and how do they fund themselves? Is this a labor of love or is there some sort of freemium model, which Simon Phipps always has an issue with?
Freemium.
Or anything like that. Yes. Every time it's a freemium project, I try to bring Simon on as my foil for that. He's really good at that.
He's good at giving him a hard time about that, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing worse is like, what's the term? Open core. I can't stand that word. Okay. I don't know why it bugs me so much. It's like open core. What the hell is that? It means you're not releasing a bunch of crap that we need, So,
Chris, when you started the show, have you noticed any changes in the open source sort of lay of the land between then and now?
Well, I'm much better looking now. There's a lot of changes, actually. One of the things that we didn't look at in the early days of the show, for whatever reason, maybe because my background is more in systems than it was in web stuff, is the creativity and activity around like the JavaScript frameworks and around that sort of whole realm of everything from Angular to Ember to all that is it's pretty remarkable. And they're a little too loosey-goosey about licensing, but put that aside. I mean, the amount of creativity and work that's been done over the years has been pretty remarkable. And you couple that with how those folks use GitHub and Git, it's pretty fantastic, actually, in my opinion. So as somebody who lives in this world of open source and licensing and the rest, it's been very interesting to see that, because we use a ton of the stuff here at Google, obviously. But that's probably been the area that's been the most interesting and surprising to me. And I think it has a lot to do with, barriers to entry and all the rest and how those folks go about releasing code and updating it and the rest. And it's been fascinating in my opinion. So.
Well, what I've seen too, and I think, I speak for all of us on this one, but, 10, 15 years ago, the idea of a company releasing what they do, that's sort of the core project of what they're working on as open source, mm-hmm. was, fighting lawyers, hand and tooth all the way up to the top, or even having a company based on having as their core product, an open source product, and they provide support services or customization or whatever as their primary means of bringing money into the door. And now it's almost a given, or maybe it's just the circles I run in, but I'm wondering if there's now more.
I'm not sure it is a given. If you look at companies that are purely open source tip to tail and then they make money from services, I think it's actually a very limited number of people who've been successful at that. Or they're just emerging out of the MongoDB types who are, let's see how they do. I think it's actually a really hard road to whatever. And
Road to hoe,
but I didn't want to.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if my farming analogy was working. Okay. But it's actually a really hard road. I mean, and this is, separate from the Android and the Chromium sort of style of releasing here. Red Hat is still, in some ways, one of the few remarkable standouts of companies that are purely open source and also are extremely successful, in my opinion. I try to think of other examples, and I do come up short,
Well, I'm just looking back through our guest list because a lot of these people, I do ask pretty early on, is this a labor of love or are you making money doing this? And a lot of them have been making money.
Both?
So, yeah. So it's kind of cool. I'm just trying to look back some recent things like, the Bro Security Analyzer, Nginx, OwnCloud,
Wireshark. Did you have Sarah Novotny on? Who'd you talk to?
Yeah, we did. was a wonderful show.
They're really interesting to watch. But again, I'd say they're very early in there. Are they gonna make this work? How are they gonna make it work? You know, so we'll see.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
But on the other side, it kind of doesn't matter because the software is out there, right? So if they make it work, great. If they don't, maybe it'll like my sequel to Percona to whomever, you know. So it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, I think that there have been other successes that I would point out. I mean, I think LibreOffice is one. Although it's not a big business success, I think
it's a terrible success from a business perspective.
Right.
But,
so
but it's really interesting from a strategy perspective
because
the way that LibreOffice and the OpenOffice official thing and the way they worked with Apache, I mean, it's all of these like circles and of these Venn diagrams of people who like and don't like each other and the legal agreements amongst the IBMs and the Sun/Oracles of the world and. It's really interesting.
Right. So. And I was also going to point out another Sun/Oracle circle, which is MySQL. And then you could also look to Postgres, which seems to be doing a lot better these days since the Oracle Sun acquisition. So again, it depends on how you define success. I think a lot of these projects that we've been talking to are very successful in their own little circle of what they're trying to accomplish. So, you know, in the best traditions of open source software, these projects are scratching an itch that really is out there, and they're solving problems for people. And so what I've noticed is a lot of these, when they are successful with their customers or users, they're very successful in that little niche. That they're addressing, and I think that's in itself is a really good measure of success.
I actually prefer that as the measure of success because people get really worked up in the Silicon Valley story and all that stuff, and or whatever, and that's just kind of dumb, you know. Yeah. I mean, as long as people are still able to eat, feed their kids, that kind of thing, you know. It's an interesting world.
But that's one of the questions I get asked most, probably. I'm sure you guys do as well, still, even these days, is how do I make money out of open source? And I can't make money out of open source. And the answer is always seems to be Red Hat, which you mentioned, but I'm not sure that
another Red Hat. That's an easy answer, right? That's certainly an easy answer. But what's funny about that is people ask me that who aren't open source developers. When I talk to actual open source developers, they're almost all gainfully employed or working in a university towards an advanced degree or something like that. I actually really rarely see open source developers who are hurting for cash, you know? And I don't know if that's just because I don't start talking to them until they hit a certain level of success or what, but it's really interesting to me because the people who tend to ask me that question are people who typically aren't software developers. You know, and I always thought that was kind of interesting. So,
I wonder how many people see the headlines like Red Hat $1 billion company, et cetera, and they're not really as interested in the open source side as they think. Maybe I could make money out of this, like the .com boom was all those years ago.
I could be selling pet food online, you know, and it's like, well, was that a good decision? You know, but it's just I also think that there's such an incredible hunger for technical talent and technical output in the form of code or whatever in the world that even if you give it away, there's still people who are going to be like, I need to pay you to help me with my thing or with implementing your thing with my thing. Or I think there's just so much hunger for that and so few people able to do it that we're just in a very advantageous position as developers,
So Chris, I've got a question for you. You're kind of in the perfect position, and if you can't talk about this, that's fine. I think you can.
Okay.
Which is, the other what I would call successful open source project that comes to mind is Android.
Sure.
Itself, right? So
over a billion ad sets. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, and I don't know why that doesn't come up more often. And even when it does, sometimes there's people that kick that back and say, "Oh, well, that doesn't count for some reason."
That doesn't count. It's too popular.
Yeah.
No one goes there.
What's up with that? I mean, how do you look at that?
Well, it's one of those things where. If you look at who cares about Android, right, there's like little boxes, right? So you have handset manufacturers and chipset manufacturers and carriers and then users. And then you have app developers, right? And they're each satisfied by Android or dissatisfied with Android in different ways, right? So that means that everyone has a sort of different perspective on how open it is or how closed it is. And I always return back to the, well, you know, it's available under the Apache license. You know, there's, you know, we have literally probably 100 million handsets out there and tablets out there that, you know, we don't even count in that billion number because it's just people who have taken Android and run with it, whether it's your Kindle Fires or your whatevers. And that sort of proves that it's really open source. And so I can go around and around in circles. But in the end, I just go, eh, whatever. You know, the code's there. I know it's there. I know it's there because I see so many people using it without even talking to us. And at the same time, Android's doing extremely well as a platform. So then people say, well, you know, fragmentation and da-da-da-da. And I'm like, well, you know, fragmentation's a problem you have when you're too open, right? And people can, you know, fragment the platform, right? So that's sort of like a proof point that it's open source. And so I used to get sort of wrapped up in these circles of thought, and I just sort of said, you know what, Android's doing a really nice job, you know, because people are using it like crazy. I was over in Shenzhen in China, and I was walking around with Nicolas Charbonnier, the ARM devices guy, who you guys probably know. And he was like, you know, showing me buildings full of tablet manufacturers. And he's like, yeah, I figure there's probably about 3 million people who are just building, you know, tablets and handsets based on Android in this area alone. And I'm just like, are you kidding me? This little open source project? I mean, and obviously not little, by any measure, but it's just, it's astonishing to watch. And so I don't think it actually counts as an open source project to a lot of people, because there's never been an open source project like it, you know, and that's really interesting, right? And I really treasure that I got to be part of it, you know, and releasing the code and keeping it releasing. So yeah, So that's my word salad for you guys to parse and see if it actually answers your question. But yeah,
no, it does. I we don't often get a chance to talk to someone in the know, so to speak, about this. And I always bring it up when I'm on This Week in Google, because it comes up a lot, the whole fragmentation issue, and then people that, you know, to go off and develop. A lot of times lately it's been coming up in the realm of security, in terms of people that develop their own stuff based on AOSP and develop their own market, and then that market isn't secure, and you know, nefarious apps get thrown in there and stuff. So
yeah, and then you have these like these charlatan, you know, antivirus companies who are like, there's so many pirated apps and,
exactly,
and malware. And I'm like, yeah, if you go to some random .ru MP3 site and start downloading apps, I mean, what the hell do you expect, you know? But yeah, if you just stick to the core Play Store, I think you're actually still pretty well served from a security perspective. Same thing with the Android, the Amazon App Store too. It's like, I think that if you kind of stick to legitimate places, and there's legitimate Chinese stores, there's legitimate Russian stores, so make no mistake. It's hard to listen to people who are just like, oh, it's a malware fest, and I'm like, no, you guys are just trying to make a buck off of scaring people,
right? Exactly.
You know? So
exactly.
And it's not to say that security isn't important, though. So it's like everything. So this is the Android story. It's like, you know, when you've shipped a billion handsets and like 1/7 of humanity is using your software, every story gets told, right? And every story is right, and every story is wrong about its open nature or its security or all the rest. Because, you know, if you're in China, you know, it's unlikely you're using the Play Store because of the unusual relationship between China and the rest of the world. And so, you know, you're likely to be on some alternative store. Which ones do you trust? Which ones do you go with, right? You know, are you going to go with the Weibo QQ thing? I mean, what's your story, right? And so it's really an interesting world when your software is everywhere, and in every context, and it sort of defies a simple description when that happens. And the same thing is true of the Linux kernel, right? It's like, you know, for every device that's running Android, it's running the Linux kernel. So what does it mean for Linux to be running everywhere, you know, on everything? It's kind of a fascinating world, you know. So
yeah, people would always talk about, you know, when is it going to be the day of the Linux desktop, right?
Oh, we got that with Android, you know?
And yeah, I mean, it may not be the Linux desktop that we were expecting, but Linux is running on all these devices. And again, to your point, in terms of, you know, back in the day, people would say, well, Linux is really secure, and it is. And I would argue that the open source development process lends itself to greater security, but there's another aspect to that, which is people aren't going to write nefarious code when it's not prolific, right? When,
that's
when
right.
the platform is
that's
not, right. and now we have a platform which is prolific, and now you're seeing people write these malware apps or take an app and tweak it somehow to be able to get some information out of it. And they're doing that because it is running everywhere. So
right.
some people get a little bit of bent out of shape saying, oh, I thought Linux was so secure. I thought open source was so secure. And it's like, well, inherently, yes, it is. But you're always going to get people writing nefarious code for popular
right.
platforms. It's just comes with the territory.
And, you know, and so this is actually a really important point because open source, there's this period where it goes from, you know, interesting to developers and just getting started out to becoming prolific like that. And that's when you're most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So you know, y'all, I'm sure, remember the years of sendmail in the like mid to late 90s, where all the configuration problems were coming out and all the sort of people using them as spam redirects. Because people had a really hard time configuring sendmail CF and these configuration files. And, you know, and then we hit times when the Linux kernel was like, oh, suddenly everyone's using it. Suddenly we're targeting it, you know, as a security, you know, the malware authors start targeting it, right? So it's funny because, like, open source is vulnerable right when it becomes popular, not after it's popular, right? Because it gets to stay popular if they address these security problems, right? Otherwise, it fades away. I mean, because, you know, when sendmail had their problems, that's when qmail took hold, you know. Apache 2, having not seen the sort of adoption maybe that the earlier versions of Apache did, it sort of opened up for NGINX. I'd say that NGINX would be the next big logical target for malware developers if I were going after servers, you know. So they're probably aware of that and are probably being very careful, you know. So it's kind of an interesting world, so.
If you don't mind, I'd like to actually shift the discussion just a second here. Looking at back at the people that we've had on the show and just for you, Chris, in general, open source projects that you're aware of and working with, how important is it to have a good, say, outgoing community manager and, you know, have public discussions about direction of the project and things like that for a good open source project's success? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that, so this is actually very similar to a question I asked to the provost of University of Michigan. I said, how important is it to have a football team, right? And he said, you know what? I've been the provost at universities that have football teams that don't, right? And what matters is once you have one, you need one, right? But if you don't have one, you don't need one. Right. And I'm like, what do you mean by that? And it's a lot like community management. Right. So what happens in open source projects, right, is that the community management either falls to the developers or someone comes in and starts adopting the role and, you know, like the Angie Byron and a Drupal kind of thing and handles it. Right. And then the developers get used to that and they like it. Right. Or it goes the other way, like Linux kernel mailing list, right? Where it's, you know, basically a free for all and people end up, you know, discovering the informal hierarchies in the absence of the formal, right? So yeah, so if you look at, you know, top 1,000 projects, however you look at it, you see everything, right? You see, you know, very focused with a good community manager, like a Sarah Novotny or something, or whatever, you know? And I know I'm probably picking on Angie and Sarah, which is good, just because I thought about them during this call. But, you know, and then you've got, I mean, who's really community management for MySQL? For a while it was Zach, and now it's some Oracle lawyer who's going to sue you if you look at him strange. And, you know, it's like, so you don't really know until you know. And so, you know, if you look at Google, we've got every variety of open source projects, some with developer relations and community management, some without, you know, and it's been interesting. Like, would you look at, for instance, angular.js and say, oh, the community management on that is really strong? Well, obviously it has a strong community, but it's, if you look at the people who actually interface, it's like Naomi and it's like the team there and they're all coders, you know? So what does it mean? I don't know. You know, what is community management? It's just somebody who likes talking to people, I guess, but it's not necessarily a person or a group of people who are necessarily said, my job is community manager, you know? So it's just, I think projects evolve the role either as a function of day-to-day operations or as a person. So,
Yeah, I'm also thinking of like the DART project, and I've been tracking that pretty closely because I'm actually doing professional development in DART already.
Cool.
And I don't know that there's necessarily a community manager there, but Seth acts a lot like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'd say that's true. And saying, you know, if you look at Go, it's like, you know, really, you know, I guess, you know, Andrew Grand would be, if anyone designated a community manager, be him, but... You know, there's Russ and there's, you know, Brad and they're all just out there just coding all the time and talking all the time. So it sort of falls to everybody, you know. And then I buy, you know, little gophers and, you know, they give them away. But yeah.
And I think we've seen in talking to companies or projects managers and things over the years that there's a, depending on how the project is run, really leads to how they use this community manager person in companies where they're doing a lot of internal development and maybe they're taking a little bit of code from the community and building it in over time. That person really is more like a marketing person. They may call themselves a community manager, but if the code's being developed internally, a lot of the times you have a marketing person involved, or you're lucky enough to have someone like Seth who is both very technically astute but can talk very well about the project, and they're doing that role. But on the other hand, when you have projects that are mostly community driven, then you really need to have that community manager person that's out there interfacing with the people that are not only developing the code but trying to get more community involvement, people to write documentation and all those things that if you're part of a company that's an open source founded company, you have those people hired on to do that kind of work. So I think it really depends on the nature of the project and what the project is. Or how the project is implemented, whether that community manager role really fits more of a marketing aspect or the community manager that I usually typically think of when we're talking about open source projects.
I was just going to say, Chris, I've got a non-technical question for you, slightly off topic, but I couldn't help noticing that there's a musical keyboard propped up behind you against the wall.
Do you play? This is the death of my dreams here. It's like I wanted to learn how to play piano for years, and I got that thing. It's been sitting in the corner for a while. I admit it's like my secret shame. I have it there so that when I do, this is Skype, which I've only used like once in the last 3 years, but my video conference rig is up there and people are always like, oh, you're playing the piano. I'm like, no, I'm not playing the piano. I basically suck. I haven't put the time into it, you know, and I have good reasons. I have a lot of things taking up the time, but you know, it's still, I keep it there as a reminder that I suck, you know?
Oh, wow. Okay. So it's a bit like one of those really impressive coffee table books that people have. You know, the ones they've never read, but they put on a coffee table to make them look good.
Well, yeah, so that's what you would think, right? That I'm being a complete poser, right? I mean, I actually use this big, stupid printer like more than I've used the keyboard, you know? So, anyways.
Okay. Yeah. That's cool. No, I just had to ask because it caught my attention. So it's definitely working. It's definitely working.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say it. I've only got a few more minutes. I mean, I have a 9:30 or whatever appointment here. So I just wanted to make sure I told you guys, you know, you've done such a great job. You know, I hear people. It's funny, too, because there's just like this sentence in my Wikipedia page that says, like, he did Floss Weekly, but he f***ed off. And I'm like, wow, thanks. That's really cool. But you guys have done a really nice job. You know, I mean, 300 episodes. I mean, that's a serious amount of time, you know? I mean, and I know the kind of work that goes into this stuff before you even turn on the microphones and the rest, and you should be really proud of that, you know? So.
And Chris, we all are. It's actually pretty cool. And I also want to thank you for having gotten the show started so that I would have something to step in the very large shoes of to try to fulfill,
you know, I mean,
on your dream about this originally.
They're like size 11 and a half. I wouldn't say they're like clown shoes. But, like, come on, you know.
And also, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to drop in today, because that really made the show
really
for us today. So
we should do a proper show, you know, later. I mean, you should use this show to, like, laud your achievements of 300. But, you know, we should do this again in a couple months or something. I'd be happy to come back.
Yeah, we haven't had you back on since show 100, I think it was. So 200 shows ago. Can you imagine that? We've done 200 shows since the last time you were on.
So what's the next Fibonacci sequence? So 1, 3, I guess I'll be back for 700, huh? Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. Absolutely.
And we'll all
absolutely
be like
Chris.
Super gray hair, more than I already am. You know, like using canes, you know.
Well, Chris, we'll let you get on to your next appointment, but really thanks for stopping by.
I'll see you guys at OSCON, though, those of you that are going. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Right. Thanks, Chris.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
That was
Chris.
That was
Thank
Chris.
You.
Yeah, that was Chris DeBona, who you might know as being on the Wikipedia page talking about the beginning of Floss Weekly. And also, he's some sort of important bigwig at Google, but we didn't actually get his title or whatever, but that's okay. He's I think he's community manager or something. He's something to do with open source there.
Yeah,
so.
I thought he was the director of open source something.
Open source, yeah. Open source there project manager,
yeah.
I thought.
Yeah.
There we go. Well, we'll just make Google it up because I forgot to get it. Let's Google for it.
Let's Google for his job at Google.
And we are almost out of time because we lose our slot in the next 15 minutes or so. So I'm going to go ahead and start wrapping up the show. First off, any thoughts from you two guys that we didn't talk about yet?
Well, I don't know if we have time, but I mean, I'd like to just cover some of our favorite episodes.
Sure, let's just do a couple minutes of that. I can do that. So you want to start, Aaron?
Yeah, sure. So a couple of them. I mean, I think my all-time, it's always hard to pick, right? But I was thinking about this over the past couple of weeks. I think one of my all-time favorites was talking to the Mars rover team, talking about how they use open source on them. And this was before the most recent one, but they were talking about how they use open source on the Mars rover and some of the technological achievements they had to make in order to plan out what they do. And if you haven't listened to that episode and you're interested in space exploration and what's going on, I think it's still very relevant to go back and listen to how their team operated, and I assume they still do, and what kind of technology they put into the Mars rover, including open source software. So I think that one was one of the top ones that I can remember. Another one that was really fun to do, and you can tell I'm into the hardware and hacking side of things, right? But another one that was fun to do was talking to the OpenPilot guys.
Which,
you know, we never got our drones, by the way, but
I know.
But that was really cool too, because that was kind of at the beginning of the whole drone revolution, if you will. Now they're becoming really popular, but back then they were just starting to get popular and people weren't sure, and how am I going to pilot this thing? And the quadcopters, there was no a counterbalancing software, or very little, and it was very hard to control, and so they wrote this software that helped counterbalance and kind of semi take over the some of the aspects of flying, especially quadcopters at the time, as well as some of the navigational software, so that you could actually go from wave point to wave point. And that was one that was also very interesting. Again, because it was kind of on the leading edge of where that technology was going, and it was all based on open source, and they're still going strong from what I understand. So that was really, really fun too. How about you guys? What do you think?
Dan?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to go for, there's so many, but just one that sticks out in my mind was, I had to look the number up, I'll admit, but number 166, where Randall and I interviewed Sam Spilsbury, who was the lead maintainer of Compiz, a 3D window manager for Linux. And the really inspirational thing about that for me was the fact that he started when he was 13, contributing to the project, and he was like 20 when we spoke to him, and he was already the lead maintainer. And it was this really amazing story about how you really can get right involved right in the core of a project and you know, really kind of make a difference with open source, I think.
Absolutely. And I liked all those shows you just mentioned as well. But I also want to bring up the fact that we've had Monty Wadenius on the show, MySQL creator, and we've had Linus Torvalds on, and just some really big names and really big projects. And like I said, we had SaltStack on early enough in its cycle that we made a difference for them. There's been a lot of fun shows. The OpenPilot show was fun, and right, I didn't get my quadcopter yet. You guys, if you're listening, send me my quadcopter. But no, let me pull up my notes here for a second here, because I want to also see if there's anything I'm leaving out. But just, you know, projects that I wouldn't have, you know, and I say this at the opening of the show, I sort of invented the opening of the show to be what I'm feeling about Floss Weekly, which is that we're talking to big projects and small projects. We're talking to things you might be using every day and not aware of it. I mean, like Nginx was fundamental. I mean, it's running about half the net now. Postgres, you know, all over the place. We had Dart on when it was early enough in the cycle that people could get excited about it and stuff. And we're always doing shows from OSCON, which is really big because we broke the story about OpenStack. So we were there sort of ahead of the curve, ahead of the news curve on it, and actually got to talk to the OpenStack people at OSCON when we were announcing. So that was really awesome too. And then other projects that are sort of are things that are helping out the world, like MyFOS. We've had them on a couple times. Microfinancing management, things like that. So they're doing real valuable stuff for the world. And I'm happy that I'm bringing awareness to that, especially helping them get volunteers back into their projects to find places that are worthy of people's time. So, yeah, it's just, you know, 300 shows. I wouldn't have imagined it when I started, but I'm glad I hit there, and I'm having a good time. I'm in it for good. So I'm always going to be around one way or the other, even if I can't host every single show. And that's the other thing I want to say is you guys, especially picking up the burden sometimes of when I have to be away, I really appreciate that you guys are willing to do that for me. Any thoughts on the host instead of a co-host sometimes?
Any thoughts on being a host or?
Yeah.
No, it's great. I mean, we're all, so I think we're all semi-professionals, right? I mean, we do this because we love it, but a lot of us have some background in either doing other podcasts or, you know, being in front of the camera. I think we all kind of bring a little bit of that with us. But the other benefit in having multiple co-hosts or hosts, as the case may be, is that we all bring our own perspective. So like I said before, you know, I've really been into the making of things lately and starting up a makerspace and all this stuff. We're always hacking on technology. And so I always typically ask the implementation questions, or at least I think I do. I hope I do. It's always like, okay, well, how? Mm-hmm. So this project sounds great and you've got a community and you're doing all this stuff. Okay, how do you actually load it on a system? Is it easy? Is it hard? What kind of server do I need? How much memory do I? That's the kind of stuff that I, you know, can I run this on my Raspberry Pi? Because if I can, I'm doing it right now off camera while we're talking, right? So I think that we all bring a unique perspective, in a different perspective. And I think that's what makes the show interesting, right? It's not always, you don't always get the same questions every week. You know, when Dan's on, he may ask something different than I ask. And I think that lends itself to keeping the show interesting and getting a little bit different perspective every time you listen or watch.
Yeah. I mean, it's been great fun to be a part of Floss, and, I think it's great. I mean, as I said, I really enjoy co-hosting and getting to speak to so many interesting people and projects that, you know, I use every day. Randall says this in the show often, the projects that you use every day that you don't even know are open source or you don't even know that you're using sometimes. It's brilliant. It's just everywhere. And I'm ready for another 300. Let's go. Let's do another 300.
Awesome. Well, we do have some shows coming up. I might as well transition to that.
Can I say one more thing quick, Randall, before
you
we...
You may, yeah.
The other thing, please. I think we need to recognize, since this is a milestone, is I know Leo's not be able to be on the show today, but he is continuing his support of this program somewhat against all odds. And I think that we need to recognize that and give a little kudos to him for keeping the show going when, you know, quite frankly, he could be investing his time in more profitable shows for the network. But yeah, I think he really believes in this. And so in his absence, I would say, you know, that we need to make sure that we thank him for his continued support of putting the show on.
Absolutely. I can do nothing but underline that 10 times, and that, you know, it's with the privilege of Leo's generosity that I get to do this show and I get to talk to all these great people and I get to bring in response a product for him to you know, fill airtime on. And I know he's basically paying for this out of his pocket because we don't have ads. So I really appreciate that he's doing this for all of us. And I also thank him for his time early on teaching me how to do podcasting so that I could do my my Geek Cruises News' podcast, which is how I first started podcasting. And, you know, it's like he's nothing but a generous man and a big-hearted man. So I really appreciate all that about him. So thank you for reminding me. I had a note to say that in about 2 more minutes, but that's okay.
I'm sorry.
This is good timing. No, this is great. That's perfect. Thank you. Anything you want to add to that, Dan, before we wrap up?
No, I was just going to say exactly the same thing. I can't agree enough, really. And it's really great that, you know, that we get to talk about so many great Floss projects and to help spread the word. Because as you've said, it has a really big effect. One thing I've noticed, especially recently, I think the show's grown in popularity, but especially recently, there's been some projects we've been on who will email me 2 or 3 weeks later and say, we can't believe the amount of attention we're getting now. This has made such a difference to us. And now we've got contributors and customers maybe that we didn't have before. Mm-hmm. And that's all down to the fact that the show is on, which again leads back to the fact that Leo lets us put it on.
Cool.
And
well,
not to mention our third, well, in this case, our fourth or fifth co-host, really behind the scenes, the guy who makes it all possible, which is John.
Yeah, John. Yeah. But he's not going to talk now. Watch.
He's not going to say anything now.
He did earlier, though. I heard him earlier. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyway, so let me wrap up because we're almost out of time here. Just a bit of news to update. The next couple of weeks are going to be about OSCON. We've got Aaron Gupta and Simon St. Laurent, who was on a few months ago, talking about the Kids Day at OSCON, and then we're actually going to be live from OSCON. Simon Phipps and I will be hunting down the news of the week and try to get a live interview with whatever is magically being announced at OSCON. I don't have a lot of other guests coming up, but you can go to twit.tv/floss, the homepage for this show, and see the link from there to talk about everybody that's coming up. Just a quick bit of notes for me. I have just been interviewed for a 20-minute segment for Linux Luddites. If you Google Linux Luddites, you go to their homepage. I talk about why I use a Mac, actually, is one of the questions they wanted to ask me, is why I use a Mac and not I'm total open source like that. I will be this Friday on This Week in Law, which is another Twit show, talking about things that probably related to my legal case, but I can't remember why they actually asked me to be on the show yet. So it's probably that. I don't know. I'll be at OSCON. Simon Phipps is going to be there as well. And as always, you can find more about me by going on to Google+, Randall L. Schwartz, or you can follow me on Twitter, MERLYN. Any quick plugs from the two of you?
Not really. Go and check out danlynch.org. You can check out the new album that my band's just done. It's Creative Commons and everything. So, you know, go and check
awesome.
It out.
Awesome. Aaron?
Yeah, just follow me on Google+. That's where I spend most of my social time, so to speak. Social networking time is on Google+. So I'm Aaron Newcomb on Google+. You can also follow me on Twitter, Facebook, whatever. I post to those networks out of Google+. So, you know, if those are your preferred networks, that's fine. Also, if you're in the Solano County area of California or down in Martinez, Pinole, Hercules, Antioch, Pittsburgh, any of those areas, please check out Benicia Makerspace. We're just getting started. And if you're into making things and you live in one of those areas and you want a place to call home and come and talk to like-minded folks, go to BeniciaMakerspace.org, the organization of which I am a president and co-founder. So please come check us out.
Well, awesome. Thanks, guys. We're out of time because I can hear that music coming up behind me. You know what that means? We'll see you all again next time on Floss Weekly.
This